Chapter 83. Among the many who have tasted the college prison's dreary hospitality was a lively young fellow from one of the southern states of America, whose first year's experience of German university life was rather peculiar. The day he arrived in Heidelberg, he enrolled his name on the college books, and was so elated with the fact that his dearest hope had found fruition, and he was actually a student of the old and renowned university, that he set to work that very night to celebrate the event by a grand lark in company with some other students. In the course of his lark, he managed to make a wide breach in one of the university's most stringent laws. Sequel. Before noon next day, he was in the college prison booked for 3 months. The 12 long weeks dragged slowly by, and the day of deliverance came at last. A great crowd of sympathizing fellow students received him with a rousing demonstration as he came forth, and of course there was another grand lark in the course, of which he managed to make a wide breach of the city's most stringent laws. Sequel. Before noon next day, he was safe in the city lockup booked for 3 months. This second tedious captivity drew to an end in the course of time, and again a great crowd of sympathizing fellow students gave him a rousing reception as he came forth. But his delight in his freedom was so boundless that he could not proceed soberly and calmly, but must go hopping and skipping and jumping down the sleety street from sheer excess of joy. Sequel. He slipped and broke his leg, and actually lay in the hospital during the next 3 months. When he at last became a free man again, he said he believed he would hunt up a brisker seat of learning. The Heidelberg lectures might be good, but the opportunities of attending them were too rare, the educational process too slow. He said he had come to Europe with the idea that the acquirement of an education was only a matter of time, but if he had averaged the Heidelberg system correctly, it was rather a matter of eternity. Appendix D. The awful German language, a little learning makes the whole world kin. Proverbs 7. I went often to look at the collection of curiosities in Heidelberg Castle, and one day I surprised the keeper of it with my German. I spoke entirely in that language. He was greatly interested, and after I had talked a while, he said my German was very rare, possibly a unique, and wanted to add it to his museum. If he had known what it had cost me to acquire my art, he would also have known that it would break any collector to buy it. Harris and I had been hard at work on our German during several weeks at that time, and although we had made good progress, it had been accomplished under great difficulty and annoyance, for 3 of our teachers had died in the meantime. A person who has not studied German can form no idea of what a perplexing language it is. Surely there is not another language that is so slipshod and systemless, and so slippery and elusive to the grasp. One is washed about in it, hither and thither, in the most helpless way, and when at last he thinks he has captured a rule which offers firm ground to take a rest on amid the general rage and turmoil of the 10 parts of speech, he turns over the page and reads, "Let the pupil make careful note of the following exceptions." He runs his eye down and finds that there are more exceptions to the rule than instances of it. So overboard he goes again, to hunt for another error and find another quicksand. Such has been, and continues to be, my experience. Every time I think I have got one of these 4 confusing cases, where I am master of it, a seemingly insignificant preposition intrudes itself into my sentence, clothed with an awful and unsuspected power, and crumbles the ground from under me. For instance, my book inquires after a certain bird. It is always inquiring after things which are of no sort of no consequence to anybody. Where is the bird? Now the answer to this question, according to the book, is that the bird is waiting in the blacksmith shop on account of the rain. Of course no bird would do that, but then you must stick to the book. Very well, I begin to cipher out the German for that answer. I begin at the wrong end, necessarily, for that is the German idea. I say to myself, Regen, rain, is masculine, or maybe it is feminine, or possibly neuter. It is too much trouble to look now. Therefore, it is either dirt, regen, or dyed, regen, or dosed, regen, according to which gender it may turn out to be when I look. In the interest of science, I will cipher it out on the hypothesis that it is masculine. Very well, then the rain is duregen, if it is simply in the quiescent state of being mentioned, without enlargement or discussion, nominative case. But if this rain is lying around, in a kind of a general way on the ground, it is then definitely located. It is doing something, that is, resting, which is one of the German grammar's ideas of doing something, and this throws the rain into the dative case, and makes it demregen. However, this rain is not resting, but is doing something actively. It is falling to interfere with the bird, likely, and this indicates movement, which has the effect of sliding it into the accusative case and changing demregen into denregen. Having completed the grammatical horoscope of this matter, I answer up confidently, and state in German, that the bird is staying in the blacksmith shop Egen on account of denregen. Then the teacher lets me softly down with the remark that whenever the word Egen drops into a sentence, it always throws that subject into the genitive case, regardless of consequences, and therefore this bird stayed in the blacksmith shop Egen de Regens. N.B.B. I was informed, later, by a higher authority, that there was an exception which permits one to say Egen den Regen in certain peculiar and complex circumstances, but that this exception is not extended to anything but rain. There are 10 parts of speech, and they are all troublesome. An average sentence, in a German newspaper, is a sublime and impressive curiosity. It occupies a quarter of a column. It contains all the 10 parts of speech, not in regular order, but mixed. It is built mainly of compound words constructed by the writer on the spot, and not to be found in any dictionary. 6 or 7 words compacted into one, without joint or seam, that is, without hyphens. It treats of 14 or 15 different subjects, each enclosed in a parenthesis of its own, with here and there extra parentheses, making pens with pens. Finally, all the parentheses and reparentheses are massed together between a couple of king parentheses, one of which is placed in the first line of the majestic sentence, and the other in the middle of the last line of it, after which comes the verb, and you find out for the first time what the man has been talking about. And after the verb, merely by way of ornament, as far as I can make out, the writer shovels in a ben sein Jewison Jehetaven Jewerden Sane, or words to that effect, and the monument is finished. I suppose that this closing hurrah is in the nature of the flourish to a man's signature, not necessary, but pretty. German books are easy enough to read when you hold them before the looking glass or stand on your head so as to reverse the construction, but I think that to learn to read and understand a German newspaper is a thing which must always remain an impossibility to a foreigner. Yet even the German books are not entirely free from attacks of the parenthesis distemper, though they are usually so mild as to cover only a few lines, and therefore when you at last get down to the verb it carries some meaning to your mind, because you are able to remember a good deal of what has gone before. Now here is a sentence from a popular and excellent German novel with a slight parenthesis in it. I will make a perfectly literal translation, and throw in the parenthesis marks, and some hyphens for the assistance of the reader, though in the original there are no parenthesis marks or hyphens, and the reader is left to flounder through to the remote verb the best way he can. But when he, upon the street, the in satin and silk covered, now very unconstrained after the newest fashion dressed, government counselor's wife met, etc., etc. 1, 1. When Erber auf der Straße der in Samt und Siege Juelten Jets sehr ungenert Natch der Nussen Moge Kleideten Regierungsrathen Begegnet. That is from The Old Mamsell's Secret, by Mrs. Marlott. And that sentence is constructed upon the most approved German model. You observe how far that verb is from the reader's base of operations. Well, in a German newspaper they put their verb away over on the next page, and I have heard that sometimes, after stringing along the exciting preliminaries and parentheses for a column or two, they get in a hurry and have to go to press without getting to the verb at all. Of course, then, the reader is left in a very exhausted and ignorant state. We have the parenthesis disease in our literature too, and one may see cases of it every day in our books and newspapers. But with us, it is the mark and sign of an unpracticed writer or a cloudy intellect, whereas with the Germans it is doubtless the mark and sign of a practiced pen, and of the presence of that sort of luminous intellectual fog which stands for clearness among these people. For surely it is not clearness, it necessarily can't be clearness. Even a jury would have penetration enough to discover that. A writer's ideas must be a good deal confused, a good deal out of line and sequence, when he starts out to say that a man met a counselor's wife in the street, and then right in the midst of this, so simple undertaking halts these approaching people, and makes them stand still until he jots down an inventory of the woman's dress. That is manifestly absurd. It reminds a person of those dentists who secure your instant and breathless interest in a tooth by taking a grip on it with the forceps, and then stand there and drawl through a tedious anecdote before they give the dreaded jerk. Parentheses in literature and dentistry are in bad taste. The Germans have another kind of parenthesis, which they make by splitting a verb in two and putting half of it at the beginning of an exciting chapter, and the other half at the end of it. Can anyone conceive of anything more confusing than that? These things are called separable verbs. The German grammar is blistered all over with separable verbs, and the wider the two portions of one of them are spread apart, the better the author of the crime is pleased with his performance. A favorite one is reist ab, which means departed. Here is an example which I culled from a novel and reduced to English. The trunks being now ready, he de after kissing his mother and sisters, and once more pressing to his bosom his adored Gretchen, who, dressed in simple white muslin, with a single tuberous in the ample folds of her rich brown hair, had tottered feebly down the stairs, still pale from the terror and excitement of the past evening, but longing to lay her poor aching head yet once again upon the breast of him whom she loved more dearly than life itself, parted. However, it is not well to dwell too much on the separable verbs. One is sure to lose his temper early, and if he sticks to the subject and will not be warned, it will at last either soften his brain or petrify it. Personal pronouns and adjectives are a fruitful nuisance in this language, and should have been left out. For instance, the same sound, sigh, means you, and it means she, and it means her, and it means it, and it means they, and it means them. Think of the ragged poverty of a language which has to make one word do the work of six, and a poor little weak thing of only three letters at that. But mainly, think of the exasperation of never knowing which of these meanings the speaker is trying to convey. This explains why, whenever a person says sigh to me, I generally try to kill him, if a stranger. Now observe the adjective. Here was a case where simplicity would have been an advantage. Therefore, for no other reason, the inventor of this language complicated it all he could. When we wish to speak of our good friend or friends in our enlightened tongue, we stick to the one form and have no trouble or hard feeling about it. But with the German tongue it is different. When a German gets his hands on an adjective, he declines it and keeps on declining it until the common sense is all declined out of it. It is as bad as Latin. He says, for instance, singular, nominative, mein guter Freund, my good friend. Genitives, meines guten Freunds, of my good friend. Dative, meinem guten Freund, to my good friend. Accusative, meinen guten Freund, my good friend. Plural, n, mein guten Freund, my good friends. G, meiner guten Freund, of my good friends. D, meinen guten Freunden, to my good friends. A, mein guten Freund, my good friends. Now let the candidate for the asylum try to memorize those variations, and see how soon he will be elected. One might better go without friends in Germany than take all this trouble about them. I have shown what a bother it is to decline a good male friend. Well, this is only a third of the work, for there is a variety of new distortions of the adjective, to be learned when the object is feminine, and still another when the object is neuter. Now there are more adjectives in this language than there are black cats in Switzerland, and they must all be as elaborately declined as the examples above suggested. Difficult? Troublesome? These words cannot describe it. I heard a Californian student in Heidelberg say, in one of his calmest moods, that he would rather decline two drinks than one German adjective. The inventor of the language seems to have taken pleasure in complicating it in every way he could think of. For instance, if one is casually referring to a house, hoss, or a horse, P-F-E-R-D, or a dog, hund, he spells these words as I have indicated. But if he is referring to them in the dative case, he sticks on a foolish and unnecessary E, and spells them pause, P-F-E-R-D-E, hund. So, as an added E often signifies the plural, as the S does with us, the new student is likely to go on for a month making twins out of a dative dog, before he discovers his mistake. And on the other hand, many a new student who could ill afford loss, has bought and paid for two dogs, and only got one of them, because he ignorantly bought that dog in the dative singular, when he really supposed he was talking plural, which left the law on the seller's side. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.